to listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
The goal of the Bilderberg Group is a one-world totalitarian government and economic system. Is the common man really as stupid as the elite seem to believe?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. War's old and new, from today's D-Day commemoration in Normandy to the battlefields of eastern Ukraine. Well, a new campaign has just been launched this week against the British government and the European Union's support for fascists in Ukraine's new Kiev government. Yes, despite the newly elected president saying he doesn't want violence, the Ukrainian army, air force and paramilitaries are still mounting deadly attacks in the east of the country against their own people. They, in turn, have held what they say are legal, but others say are illegal, referenda, saying they want nothing to do with the new regime, which they say came into power in a NATO, US and EU-backed coup. Well, also, the 70th anniversary of D-Day is all over the media today, but was Operation Overlord, the Normandy landings, really the turning point in the war, as so many commentators are saying? Or did that come 2.5 years previous to that, in early 1942, over in Stalingrad, when the Russians began to turn around the German advance? We look 3 months ahead of D-Day to September 1944 and Operation Market Garden, begin to look at some of the events around it, as deals were done between Britain, the US and the Nazis for their precious technology, which included uranium and possibly plutonium too for the Manhattan Project. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of some of the world's hotspots too. But we start this week with Jay Blackwood, who's joining us here in the studio. He's from this new campaign, Bristol's Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity Campaign. Hi, Jay, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello there, thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jay.
I'm sort of semi-retired at the moment. I've been living in Bristol for about 10 years. My partner was Ukrainian, and through her, she died a few years back, but through her, obviously, I met other Ukrainians and Russians, particularly when I was living in London, and I've been out to Ukraine myself.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the country for people who've never visited it. Obviously, we've got Marina, who works on this show. She's actually over in the Ukraine at the moment, and she has been quite critical of the Russians in all of this, but just give us your own personal view of what about the country when you sort of land and you get out of the plane or you drive over there or whatever. What's different about Ukraine to here in Bristol and Britain?
I think there are, the most obvious thing is that there's a very rich history and a very conflicted history in Ukraine. So you see that in simple things like the architecture, where you have kind of beautifully designed buildings from the 18th century next to Soviet-era concrete monstrosities. You see that in Odessa itself, which is a very beautiful city. And that kind of reflects the troubled history that the country has had. And to some extent, it reflects the really big ethnic and cultural divides in Ukraine as well.
Okay, so what is the Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity Campaign? What is it all about?
Well, we're hoping to cut through really what's been a wall of propaganda in the Western media. And that propaganda has principally been aimed at portraying the overthrow of the previous elected government in Ukraine as a sort of popular revolution that was fought in the name of democracy, in the name of being European, and that was fought as a kind of anti-imperialist struggle against the Russians.
Well, hang on, because it was, surely. I mean, I saw back in November last year, even, there were people coming to the main square, Maidan Square in Kiev, all sorts of people, different shapes and colours from
Absolutely.
All over the country, saying, look, we've just had enough of this government.
Absolutely. It was a corrupt government, as the present one is as well already, because what you have in Ukraine and what you've had since the fall of the old Soviet bloc, which I'm certainly not here to defend, but what you've had is a government of oligarchs, one government after another. Some of them play to the people in the east, some of them play primarily to the people in the west. They're corrupt governments. But what you saw in the Maidan protests was when those protests actually moved to seize state power, it wasn't the ordinary protesters that were there from the start, the people in colourful costumes that overthrew the government. It was the paramilitaries of Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, which are the fascist parties in Ukraine.
OK, tell us about those two parties.
OK, Svoboda is, in a way, the most worrying. Pravi Sektor is an out-and-out open fascist party, and Svoboda is a party that's, in a sense, done a BNP, in that it's fronted by men in suits. They now hold a third of the posts in the current government, even after the recent election. Those posts include the Interior Ministry, National Security, Defence, the Defence Council, setting up a National Guard. They originated as the National Socialist Party of Ukraine. Their symbol was the wolf's angle, which is a Nazi insignia. And then a few years back, under advice from other organisations, including groups in the West, they were really advised to put up a more democratic front. But even very recently, the European Parliament, which obviously has backed the Maidan movement, criticised them as a neo-fascist anti-Semitic organisation and advised people to have nothing to do with them. So even the EU, a couple of years ago, saw through the facade to the Nazis underneath it.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, can I just bring you in here? Because obviously this is a bit worrying when you've got these kinds of fascist parties in such key positions, as Jay was just listing there, in the present government.
Yes, and if you go back to February the 22nd, when the coup took place, there was a discussion in the morning between
Yanukovych
and the EU negotiators and the leaders of the opposition parties, and an agreement was made for early elections, government of national unity, for the protesters to calm down, and a deal was being done. As that deal was being put in place, the only person not in the room discussing what should happen was a representative of the United States of America. They were excluded from the discussion. But as they left the meeting, snipers started shooting both police officers, Berkut riot police, and protesters. And ultimately, a taped phone call between Catherine Ashton and Umas Piets, the head of the Estonian Foreign Ministry, he had gone round the hospitals, and he was hearing from the doctors that all of the people killed had been killed by the same set of snipers using the same bullets, all mostly coming from Hotel Ukrainia, which was under the control of Pravi Sektor and Pravi Sektor's leader, Andrei Paruby. Now, in other words, they came to power by shooting those protesters that you mentioned earlier, the ones in the colourful costumes, the people who just wanted to join the EU and all the rest of it. Now, this fits a pattern. It's these people are fascists, that's for sure, but they've had linkages with NATO's intelligence services going back.
But why would Pravi Sektor shoot their own supporters?
They're not shooting their own supporters. In any case, it's not entirely clear that Pravi Sektor, these snipers were professionals. It's quite possible that it wasn't, in fact, just random fascists who were doing the shooting. The point is that these groups have linkages with NATO's intelligence services going back a long way. And people who frequently listen to this programme will know that we constantly talk about Gladio. Gladio was set up as a secret structure within NATO, carrying out terrorist attacks in Western Europe through the 70s and 80s, including the bombing of Bologna railway station, probably the biggest one that they carried out, killed 80-odd people. It's quite clear from investigations by the Italian police force that this was carried out by NATO, and that means CIA MI6. I see CIA MI6 fingerprints all over this, and of course I'm quite sure that the Russian secret services see it exactly that way. They are behaving very calmly in the face of what is extreme provocation. And then we got even more provocation in Odessa, which I'm sure that Jay knows that again was another organised provocation. And the key person in both provocations is this guy, Paruby. Now, he, in fact, is the quarterback. We need to sack him. Well, you need to be asking questions of our representatives here and in Europe, saying, what are we doing about Andrei Parubi? He's the guy that killed all the people in the Maidan, and he's the guy that killed all the people in Odessa. And, of course, he's probably working with MI6 and CIA.
OK, but before we hear from Jay Blackwood on what happened in Odessa, what's your thoughts about what happened back in February? I think it was the 23rd, wasn't it, Martin? I think it was a Friday, as I remember, while this show was going out, there was all these sniper shootings going on. And at the end of the negotiations with Yanukovych, there was a load of military people basically stormed their parliament. So what's your view about what happened that day and how relevant that is?
I think that there are obviously different takes on who was behind it exactly and on what went on the day. There are as with everything with Ukraine at the moment, there are what you might call different narratives, and they're backed up by different people. I find Martin's view of this very interesting, and it's something that I would want to look into further. What my understanding is, I mean, the shooting took place and then the parliament building was stormed and the government was overthrown. Now, whoever carried the shooting out, and however corrupt the existing government was, it was an elected government. It was important because in a country that's riven by cultural differences, to actually completely destroy any pretense of a democratic change of government in favour of storming the parliament building on behalf of, if you like, one cultural ethnic group. Using the word ethnic is dangerous in this situation, but let's say one cultural or national group. As soon as that happened, everything changed. And from that moment on, what we're beginning to see now, which is a kind of descent into an awful civil war, was almost inevitable.
Okay, what about Odessa? What happened there?
Well, in Odessa, and I know Martin's spoken quite a lot about this, I think, as well, what we certainly had, sifting through the conflicting accounts, is a situation where you had a protest camp outside the trade union building in Odessa. And that protest camp was basically a protest against the putsch in Kiev, a protest against the new government and the fascist elements within it, and an expression as well of anxiety amongst Russian speakers in Ukraine about the direction the country was going in. That was attacked. There doesn't seem to be any dispute about that. There was then an assault on the building itself where the protesters took refuge. And we know that 42 people were killed, maybe a lot more, and obviously a lot more were injured. At the very least, they were firebombed to death. There's a lot of evidence that it went deeper than that, that people were murdered inside the building, that Pravi Sector, one of the two fascist groups particularly, were involved in organising that, and that the police in Odessa collaborated in order to basically muddy the water in terms of responsibility. And there was a big furore about that after the event, throughout Europe, actually, and in Ukraine itself.
Well, I know it's been very important for you as an individual to go into this in your own way, to look into and research what actually happened, because you know you're saying, as and I would agree with you, that there are particularly slanted propagandistic views coming at this from the Western media. But it's another step, isn't it, to actually moving towards setting up actually a campaign. So why did you set the campaign up?
Basically, this has been set up by myself and two or three other individuals. That's how it started. And now, fortunately, there are other Bristolians, and I was talking to a Ukrainian woman in Bristol earlier on today who's going to be involved. It's building up. But we established it because what we believe is happening in Ukraine at the moment is something that could develop in the direction of what we saw in Spain in 1936. For the first time in Europe itself, and we can see echoes of this in countries like Greece with the Golden Dawn movement, but for the first time in Europe itself since the Second World War, we're actually seeing fascists in government, backed by Western capital, backed by the United States particularly, given logistical advice by the United States. And what we're seeing in the East is the direct result of that, which is a war by the Kiev government against its own people, using heavy artillery, tanks, attack helicopters, aeroplanes, and so on. If you have fascists in government, that's what you get. And we want, in our own way, to build solidarity with the people fighting that. There's also a national campaign, which was launched last week. And we're also going to link up with that. So we're hoping this will build into a national movement to raise awareness, really, as well as solidarity.
Well, some will say you're being a bit paranoid, that actually the far right over there is really maybe more like the BNP or something like that here, which is not such a large movement, certainly doesn't have access to the sort of private armies that you're suggesting, and also that there is a legitimate concern that the breakaway groups in the east of Ukraine are actually just simply breaking the law now, that there's been a presidential election, and the idea that they can just sort of separate from Ukraine and become another country. Well, I mean, surely people can't simply do that. I mean, here in Bristol, maybe we would like to, but we can't just stick two fingers up at Westminster and say, sorry, guys, we're having nothing to do with you anymore.
I mean, the difference is that when that recent election was held, East Ukraine was already under military attack, heavy military attack, on the day of the election from its own unelected government in Kiev, the government which has this big fascist presence. And in those circumstances, nobody, apart from the Western media, who've played an extraordinary role, could really say those would count as free and fair elections. It's okay, let's imagine somebody in Bristol decided, yes, we're going to have a West Country Republic. We don't like what London's doing. We never have. We're going to have a republic. Let's have a vote on it. But first, let's put up with being bombed, shelled, shot down in the streets, and let's see how the vote goes and abide by the result. You know, we wouldn't really see that as democracy in any form that we recognise. For fascists, it's a very familiar form of democracy. It's the democracy of the bullet.
What about Spain, 1936? You mentioned that. What happened there, and why do you draw this comparison with today?
The comparison is that in Spain you had a situation where fascism was, I mean, eventually did come to power, and you had a civil war that was fought to defeat the forces of fascism. At the time, similarly to what we have in Ukraine now, the forces of fascism were colluded with by American capital and by West European capital. We're seeing the same thing now. We're seeing the same attempts to confuse the issue, to muddy the waters. And amongst some, there's a growing feeling in the labour movement, the trade union movement, we're beginning to see a shift where people recognise that just as in Spain in 36, there was a need for solidarity to fight fascism, we need that now as well, because fascism plus finance capital plus American Western intelligence and power really needs more than just the citizen militias in the east of Ukraine to fight it successfully.
Well, George Orwell and others went over to help, didn't they, in the Spanish Civil War to fight against Franco. Are you saying that people should maybe do the same in Ukraine?
I think I'd be reluctant to actually say that on the radio regardless. I don't want Inspector Knacker knocking on my door later on tonight. I think what people do in terms of solidarity at the moment is more to do with raising awareness, and I don't mean that in a wishy-washy way. I mean bringing it up in their trade unions, bringing it up in their political organisations, and starting to tackle the media, which is why it's really good that we can even have this discussion on here today, because this is not a discussion we're really hearing anywhere else. So I think solidarity is practical and direct in that way. I'm not necessarily suggesting to people they should go over there and pick up a Kalashnikov.
Martin, do you think Jay's correct in drawing comparisons with Spain in 1936?
Yes, and the other comparison I draw is with Yugoslavia, where I used to work in the 90s. Mm. And of course, when Slovenia declared independence of Yugoslavia, the West, and they opened fire on the Yugoslav National Army, the Slovenian National Guard, the West cheered them on. And this is why the Russians say, well, hang on a minute, when Slovenia breaks away, when Croatia breaks away, when Kosovo breaks away, you cheer them on. And in actual fact, when the Slovenians didn't have to shoot the National Guard, the Yugoslav National Army, but they knew that if they did, it would precipitate. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence that the militias in the east started the fighting with the Ukrainian army. The Ukrainian army came to fight with them.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I'd point out is that underlying all of this is the economic policy in Ukraine. I wrote a book about economic policy in Eastern Europe with Laszlo Andor, who's now a European commissioner, who's a Hungarian guy. And in that book, published in 1998, we said if they try to enforce IMF structural adjustment in Ukraine, just like in Yugoslavia, the state will disintegrate. Don't forget, Crimea was only tacked onto Ukraine in 1952. Mm. The whole country has only been an independent state since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. It never existed as a state in that before that. And in the very word Ukraine simply means borderland in the Slavic language.
Well, it's pretty big. It's the most enormous borderland country in Europe.
And that's why the Second World War, when we come to the Second World War, the Second World War was decided in Ukraine. I mean, the sadness of the history of the region is palpable. I used to live in Poland, and they used to carry out any kinds of building work, and people find mass graves. And this is all living memory. Mm. Same in Yugoslavia.
Anyway, Jay, what's happening in Ukraine today, then?
Well, today, literally, we've seen a stepping up of the attacks. I mean, what's interesting is, you know, we've had the election of this guy, Poroshenko, who's another oligarch. He's the chocolate king of Ukraine, which makes him sound really nice and kind of cuddly. And the first thing he did when he came to power was to talk about ending the civil war. But since then, it's clear that his way of ending the civil war is to end it with a military victory. Today, we've seen tanks attacking the town of Slavyansk, which is in the Donetsk region in the east. And what we're beginning to see off and on is an intensification of the fighting. And amongst those troops that are attacking the civilian centres in the east, we have this National Guard that was set up by Andrei Perubi, who is the founder of Svoboda, the fascist party. They're fighting alongside the troops, partly because we've seen troops defect and refuse to fire on their own people. Having a neo-Nazi standing next to you with a revolver is a good way of ensuring that you actually carry out orders, and that's what's happening. So today we've seen that. We've also seen, bizarrely, Putin, who's been put forward as the new great Satan for the West, talking to Poroshenko about compromise. Mm-hmm. The idea that East Ukraine is all about Russian influence and wanting to be annexed to Russia is palpably not true. Russia is very wary indeed about direct involvement in eastern Ukraine.
And is that simply because that could draw them into a conflict with NATO? We've already heard that NATO are going to be carrying out exercises in Ukraine.
Absolutely. And the opposition to those NATO exercises, that's something that our campaign will be supporting and has been supporting. No, Russia is very nervous for two other reasons, not just because of how the West will react. It's very nervous because, frankly, East Ukraine, although it's an industrial heartland, is a run-down and decaying industrial heartland. There's a lot
it
of
sounds
poverty.
Like the north of England.
Well, there's a lot of similarities. Old industry. On steroids, yeah. There's a lot of old industry. The other thing is, in Russia you have, and have had for a long time, the rule of the oligarchs. As opposed to what you hear on the BBC and so on, it is a democratic country, although it's a faltering democratic country. But, you know, Putin's elected and re-elected because he's popular. But what the oligarchs in Russia don't want is an armed militant population to suddenly come into the Russian Federation, because that would destabilise it. And that's really not in the interests of the Russian ruling class.
Now, the comparisons with former Yugoslavia, Martin, and Spain, what does that tell us about what might happen in Ukraine?
Well, I think Putin, by saying that he's going to talk to Poroshenko, I mean, Putin came to power, he disciplined the oligarchy, sent Khodorkovsky to prison and so on, but, you know, he's also a representative of the oligarchy. But I think he's actually a very skillful politician. I wouldn't vote for him. I'd probably vote communist if I lived in Russia. But, I mean, he's a very skillful politician. And what he's saying to Poroshenko is, look, you've got some kind of a mandate. So have the people in the East Ukraine. Why don't we just sit down and sort this out? Call your dogs off and let's come to some arrangement about this. And that's perfectly straightforward and logical. And that's the sort of thing that we were trying to get people to do in Bosnia back in the 90s. Look, stop shooting, everybody. Everybody stop shooting and let's have a chat.
But fascists don't always respond when you say, let's sit down and come to some arrangement.
No, but underlying all of this is NATO's strategy. LEAP 2020, the French think tank that I often look at their stuff, they pointed out straight away what this is all about is the trade partnership deal with the US, the TIIP. I can't remember what the
TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership.
That's the one I'm talking about. And of course, Perfectly normally, relations within the European Union and the Russian Federation are the economic ties are thickening and strengthening. And ultimately, what this does is it draws an iron curtain across Europe. Don't do deals with the Russians, do deals with us, i.e. America. And the German ruling class are being put on the spot here, because they would quite happily do very good, they're already doing very, very lucrative deals with the Germans. You've got three former German chancellors who are criticising Merkel's position on all of this. And, of course, what's happening is that the European Union is being stampeded in a certain direction. So NATO strategists have got what they want out of this, which is just to create tension between Russia and the EU, and therefore, you know, divide and rule. Strangely enough, Marine Le Pen from the French National Front made exactly that point. This is an American war to make trouble for Europe. That's what she's saying.
I mean, we've also heard Nigel Farage actually questioning the EU's policy there. So this is bizarre. We've got the right wing, or we might say far right, not or extreme right, or anyway, whatever UKIP are, saying what the EU is doing is wrong here. They're sort of it doesn't seem to make sense. You would expect that they would maybe be supporting other far right people, but they're not. They're saying completely the opposite.
Yes, but what Nigel Farage has got wrong about this is it isn't the EU that's doing this, it's NATO and the Americans. I mean, was it famously Victoria Nuland said, F the EU, and that's the whole point of all of this, is to make the EU dysfunctional and undermine relations with the Russians.
And in the meantime, we've heard this week the President Obama has announced a plan. This is the day before the D-Day celebrations, commemorations, to invest $1 billion in stepping up its military presence in Eastern Europe amid the Ukrainian crisis. White House will send more troops and equipment to the region and reaffirm its commitment to its NATO allies. He was speaking at a news conference in Warsaw. Obama said America was stepping up its partnership with the countries in Eastern Europe with a view to bolstering security. Moves are aimed at upping the pressure on Russia, which Washington is accused of inciting unrest in Ukraine, Jay.
Yes, I mean, I think the strategy that the US is following, that NATO is following, the long-term strategy is pretty obviously to completely encircle and isolate Russia. And I think it's part of the kind of broader approach, which is, you know, you had that strategy put forward years ago, the new American century, where the idea is that the US will dominate in all arenas and in all geographical areas. And part of that is to cut off and encircle Russia. And we saw that with the attempt. I mean, part of what was going on in Ukraine was really, I suppose, the dream on the part of the US State Department that Russia would lose Crimea and the base of its Black Sea fleet. So I think there's a grand game being played by the Americans. It's extremely a very, very dangerous game, not least for Europeans, East and West. And I think one of the interesting things is, if you talk to Ukrainians and Russians and people from that region, and I'm sure Martin would have probably seen this in the former Yugoslavia, the view from the East, looking west, is very different from the view that we're given in this country. They see a growing power, a growing aggression, and a growing encirclement. And we really need to be more aware of that if we want to engage in international politics and diplomacy, as opposed to simply fight an endless series of proxy wars across the world.
Can I just say about Warsaw, the Polish magazine Nie, which is basically private eye, they were reporting that Parubi's people were trained at a police academy outside Warsaw before they were sent back to take over in Kiev. So in other words, I think the evidence is piling up that these provocations were not carried out by the fascists and the West turning a blind eye. They are working closely with them. And of course, Catherine Ashton, it's quite clear from the intercepted telephone call, is not in the loop. She's going, gosh, really? That's shocking. So what you've got is the EU being used as a condom by NATO. And this is where Nigel Farage didn't get it right. It's not the EU that's making the problems here. It's NATO, which is underpinning the EU, of course. And, of course, NATO has been carrying out bomb attacks and assassinations in Western Europe for decades now. There's a book came out 18 months ago now by Fernando Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. It's called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, and it's quite clear that from the bombing in Piazza Fontana in 1969 right through, and there was a similar things happening in Brabant massacres in Belgium, the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in Germany, NATO intelligence services are out of control. They've been out of control for a long time, and it's not something that they've just got out of control. The evidence is there. There have been three parliamentary inquiries in Switzerland, in Italy and in Belgium. The European Parliament has passed a resolution about all of this. The fact of the matter is that CIA and MI6 are terrorists, and the Russian Secret Service know that very well. They're terrorists as well, that's why they know.
Okay, Martin, I'm going to come back to a question I asked you before, which you sort of stepped round or maybe got slightly diverted, which is the experience of former Yugoslavia and Spain, 1936. What does that tell us that might happen in Ukraine as a projected future?
Well, what would be nice to happen is if Poroshenko shows some independence from his Western masters and leads Ukraine in the obvious direction for it to go, which is to be friends with everybody. There's no reason. I mean, that's basically what Yushchenko in the end wouldn't sign up for the deal because it was too much against Ukraine's interest. If you're going to have an IMF structural adjustment policy, you're saying to everybody in the East Ukraine, the Rust Belt, we're going to put you all out of work. We're not going to put you on the dole because there isn't any dole. We're just going to put you out of work. Yep. That's what we're going to do with you. Now, that, of course, there's not been a structural adjustment in Ukraine as there was in Russia in the 90s, the Gaidar plan and so on, because everybody realised that it was a Yugoslavia waiting to happen. What caused the Yugoslavian war was IMF structural adjustment policies, forcing the country to make decisions that they didn't want to make. When the pie is shrinking, somebody's got to lose some pie, haven't they? So who's going to lose pie? More pie? Is it going to be Slovenia? Is it going to be Serbia? And the same thing happens in Ukraine. If we're going to shrink the pie, and of course the Ukrainian economy now is in freefall, that's what's going as a result of all this.
Okay, Jay, what are your concerns about the future? If things don't go well in Ukraine?
I mean, my main concern, and this comes partly from, I think to some extent, the people that smelt a rat with this stuff quite early on were people that maybe had some prior experience of Eastern Europe in some form, you know. And the worry is, and this came up very early on, what we'll see in Ukraine will be ethnic cleansing, and ethnic cleansing on a scale that will make the Balkan War, the breakup of Yugoslavia, look like a picnic. I mean, you now have a modern army with a fascist militia alongside it. It's an open question whether Poroshenko could move against the fascists in his government, even if he wanted to. He doesn't control the army, he doesn't control the Justice Department or the police. So what you could have is a situation where the armies of West Ukraine basically move to crush the cities in the east, and to do that effectively, they would have to carry out an absolute slaughter. That's the main worry. The possibility is of a sane federal solution to the question. And I'm afraid to say, I mean, from the moment where the Americans and the Europeans threw a match into the powder keg, that was always going to be the most favourable outcome. The idea that Ukraine would continue in its existing form once the whole thing was blown out of the water was always going to be unlikely. But the risks are, at worst, not only that you have ethnic cleansing, but that you have a neo-fascist government holding absolute power in the centre of Europe.
And also, we've got these next month NATO exercises scheduled, not actually in Ukraine, but around Ukraine. We've just heard also that Britain is offering tanks and 1,000 troops for this NATO show of strength against Putin. British Armoured Battle Group could join the NATO manoeuvres in Poland as the alliance reinforces exercises in response to the Ukraine crisis. That's in the Daily Telegraph. Britain offering NATO an armoured battle group, including 25 tanks, to join exercises in Poland. So this is next month. This does seem a little bit unnecessary at the moment because the Kiev government doesn't seem to be threatened by military force from the east of Ukraine, and neither from Russia.
No, absolutely. I mean, my understanding is the exercises will actually be in Ukraine itself as well, but we may have different. I mean, things are changing day by day, but certainly the Stop the War Coalition, which is the national, you know, sort of anti-war group that was formed over Iraq, they are saying that those exercises will actually take place on Ukrainian soil. So if that happens in the midst of what is developing into a civil war, you could be looking at World War III. I mean, if I can say, part of the reason that Russia may eventually intervene against its own ruling class's interests is pressure from below in Russia, pressure from people in Russia. If you see ethnic cleansing on a large scale in the east, the majority in Russia will not stand by and let that happen. That's something else that we need to be aware of. It's not just down to Putin. and what Putin wants. It's also down to the amount of popular pressure from below over this issue.
Martin, I'm just looking at the mainstream press articles on these exercises. It does look as if they are around Ukraine, not in Ukraine. But what are your thoughts about the wisdom or otherwise of that?
Well, it's just pouring more fuel on the fire, isn't it? What they need to do, and what they should be doing at this D-Day commemoration and all the rest of it, is get banging a few heads together. And Putin, basically, is offering himself, saying, I will be a mediator for you with these East Ukrainian people. I'm going to talk to this Poroshenko chap. And what he actually said, Poroshenko doesn't have blood on his hands. Which is actually not true, because Poroshenko, it seems to me, said that he was going to fix the East Ukraine in a matter of days or hours, and that's crazy. I mean, somebody, I don't know who said earlier that they're a modern Ukraine. The Ukrainian army isn't modern. That's why they've got all these kind of paramilitary groups attached to them. Mm. At the moment, we've got what is basically irregular warfare. It seems that the Donetsk and Luhansk militias have got access to ground-to-air equipment. And that's going to be a game-changer, because they shot down a helicopter with the commander of the Ukrainian National Guard in it and various other people. Mm, yeah. If the rebels in Syria had ground-to-air facilities, they might have done rather better than they have, although, of course, this is all tied in with what's happened in Syria, where it looks as if Bashar Assad has got more of a mandate, for example, than Sisi managed to get in Egypt the week before.
Okay, well, so we've heard also today that at the D-Day celebrations, the new president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, has met Putin in the diplomacy behind D-Day. There'll be some stuff about that on Channel 4 News after this show. But as they met in France at a commemoration ceremony, they say, for the D-Day landing 70 years on, Russia's President Vladimir Putin and the Ukrainian President-elect Petro Poroshenko jointly called for an end to the bloodshed still taking place in Ukraine. In a brief conversation, both the men called for a speedy end to bloodshed in the southeast Ukraine, as well as fighting on both sides by the Ukrainian armed forces, as well as by supporters of the federalisation of Ukraine. It's the first time the pair have met since Moscow annexed Crimea earlier this year, and comes as the fighting continues in the east of Ukraine around Donetsk and Slavyansk. Clashes between Ukraine's military and pro-Russian protesters, which Russia denies having any official links to despite Western accusations, have in fact intensified since the election of pro-Western businessman Petro Poroshenko. Jay Blackwood, I mean, this does sound like at least there's dialogue going on, but whether it's going to go anywhere?
It's a good question. I mean, there's the idea that Putin has control over the militias in East Ukraine, I think, is actually it's not an accurate reflection of what's going on. There may be some Russian fighters that have crossed the border into East Ukraine. I'd be surprised if there weren't. But basically what you have is militias raised in those cities. Ukraine is a country swimming with ex-Soviet era hardware. Mm-hmm. When I was in Ukraine on holiday, I was offered a gun. I said, oh, I don't really want to buy a gun. I'm here for a vacation. So I was offered a Kalashnikov. I mean, this is a country absolutely swimming with armaments. The idea that the fighters in the east are armed by the Russians is only an idea that holds water for people that don't really know much about Eastern Europe. Whether Putin and Poroshenko will be able to come to any meaningful agreement is different from the question of whether they can put out an anodyne statement saying we all want peace, now, because of course we all do.
Yeah, I know you've got a petition running, haven't you, about these forthcoming exercises?
Yep, there's a petition. If people Google Stop the War Coalition, that will point to the petition calling on NATO and, well, for Britain to withdraw from those NATO exercises.
I'd like to hear what Nigel Farage has to say about that.
Okay, and that's Jay Blackwood, you were hearing there, who was one of the founders of the Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity Campaign. You can find more about that on the internet at buafs.wordpress.com. So, Jay Blackwood, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. Be the Vietnam era, I think, from the early 1970s, late 1960s. There's the Jefferson Airplane there with Greasy Heart. Martin, now the D-Day celebrations today.
We're going to talk. Commemorations.
I keep saying that. There was a mini D-Day, wasn't there, back in 1942, involving the Canadians.
Yes.
Well, the date was Wednesday, the 19th of August, 1942, in Dieppe.
Yeah, I mean, it was supposedly. Nobody's ever satisfactorily explained what Dieppe was really about.
It was a raid on the French coast.
With hindsight, it all seems pretty silly. They were actually attacking the most heavily armoured. They subsequently said, well, we had to do this to find out that we couldn't attack ports. We'd have to go onto the beaches on D-Day. But it was pretty obvious that the ports were going to be pretty well defended, and they were pretty well defended. And the basic point to make, of course, is that the Soviet Union were putting the West under pressure to open a second front. The West didn't want to open a second front because actually the strategy is to let the Russians and the Germans knock each other to pieces.
Well, this is one of the things that's been talked about.
Then come in and clean up at the end.
Talked about today as this being the turning point of the war. But actually, in a way, D-Day was a way of the Americans and the British entering the fray in Europe in order to stop the Russians winning the war on their own.
Yes, basically. And, of course, they could have done it earlier, possibly. I mean, there's lots of historical dispute about all of this, of course, but everybody agrees that Dieppe was a disaster. The Canadians, in particular, took very heavy casualties. And, of course, then Churchill and Roosevelt can turn around to Stalin and say, look, we tried in Dieppe, look how difficult it is, ooh, terrible.
In other words,
it was actually designed to fail, is what some historians
think. Anyway, over future weeks, we'll be looking at some of the deals which were being done between D-Day and the end of the war, and we're looking 3 months ahead now to September 1944 in Operation Market Garden. And I spoke last week to Tim Saunders, who's a military historian who lives locally and wrote the book on Nijmegen. This is all about this Operation Market Garden from September 1944, which was an absolute failure. But to what extent it was a mistake and to what extent the battle was thrown, well, those questions we'll be looking at over the next few weeks. But anyway, for now, we will hear Tim Saunders, who really is one of the top people on this Nijmegen battle. He's written one of the probably most definitive books on it. So we go forwards 3 months now to September 1944.
Major Tim Saunders from the Devonshire and Dorset Regiment, latterly of the Rifles. And I got interested in Market Garden as a whole because my regiment was there in the form of 4th Dorsets, the only ground troops to have got across the Rhine. And I remember going to one ceremony, the commemorations in September, and having veterans of my regiment heckled by other soldiers, or you're late again and things like that, fired my interest, and it's kept me going for quite some time.
Now, I know Colonel Frost, who was at the Arnhem Bridge, he actually apparently shook his fist in the air at one of the reunions, 1984, I think it was, the 40th anniversary, and said, call that fighting. So why is it that there is this resentment that the ground troops, after they took the Nijmegen Bridge, why didn't they just rush immediately straight up to Arnhem?
Well, first of all, the reasons go right way back to the conception and the planning of the operation. It was an incredibly complex operation, mounted in just 14 days, with corps, indeed different armies, either side of the channel, with no way of practical face-to-face or direct telephone communication. It just wasn't possible in those days, so coordination wasn't particularly good. And the airborne plan was, to say the least, casual. It was actually made much, much worse because in the run-up to the launching of the operation, just with days to go, by which time, of course, the troops had been dispersed to their airfield and therefore really, really difficult to get hold of and rebrief and reorientate and adjust plans. The Royal Air Force and the US Army Air Force cancelled significant number of coup de main at the Somme Bridge, at the Nijmegen Bridge and at the Arnhem Bridge. And these changes fundamentally cut to the chance of success.
So just explain what a coup de main is.
Coup de main is either by parachute or glider, landing literally as close as possible to the objective, seizing it before the enemy can do anything about it. And where the coup de main were allowed, at Pfeffel and at Grave, strangely enough, there was success. Where they weren't allowed, at Son, Nijmegen, Arnhem, there was failure. Also, once the drop had happened on the afternoon of the 17th, just one drop per day because of aircrew tiredness, the 82nd Airborne, who are to seize the heights around Groesbeek, Nijmegen and the Waal bridges, they were victim of this cock-up, this change of plan that General Gavin had been unable to communicate effectively to his battalions. And in his memoirs, he actually confesses to this being a bit of an error, but that's about it. What happened was, at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, he found a battalion at Sionshof just digging in. And he was absolutely furious, because he thought they were the ones who should be marching to the bridge. In the meantime, of course, the Germans had reacted. In Nijmegen, they were piling troops, railway police, all kinds of rear echelon troops into and around the bridge. And by the time that that battalion had got itself moving, entering Nijmegen at 10 o'clock that night, 9 hours after the drop, they met head-on a German recce battalion, an armoured recce battalion, and paratroopers versus armour, the result was a foregone conclusion. The Germans had vitally seized the Nijmegen Bridge. In fact, from the outset, they had realised. Dietrich, the corps commander of 2nd SS Panzer Corps in the woods between Apeldoorn and Arnhem, had realised Nijmegen was the Schwerpunkt, the crux of the whole operation. Stop the Allies there for long enough and he could destroy the airborne division at his leisure. He deployed the Hohenstaufen 9th SS Panzer Division to keep as much of the British airborne division away from Arnhem as possible, and he sent the Frundsberg south. The Schwerpunkt is south. And his recce battalion was that battalion that arrived in Nijmegen before the American airborne forces did. So, right from the outset, Nijmegen was where the battle was to be lost. The fact that the Somme Bridge had also been lost, once again, due to a lack of coup de main, it was far too close to the Eindhoven airfield and all the German flak there that the air forces didn't want to risk their aircraft there. So that wasn't taken, and that took a considerable time to capture and bridge. And it didn't help as well that the Guards Armoured Division were badly delayed getting through Valkenswaard, frankly by a highly successful area ambush mounted by German Fallschirmjäger in the forests just on the Dutch border.
But coming back to the evening of the Wednesday when they finally did take the Nijmegen Bridge, surely at that point it was down to the ground troops to rush to relieve, to be the reinforcements to relieve the final remnants of the 1st Airborne Division at Arnhem Bridge.
Well, you would think that, but you've got to remember, yes, there were two divisions in Nijmegen, the Guards Armoured Division, 82nd, but if you look at a map, you can see that they were encircled in the town and on the Groesbeek Heights. From the south and from the southeast, they were being attacked on the Mook and the Reichsfeld-Groesbeek axis. One battle group of the Guards Armoured Division was heading back down Hell's Highway because that had been cut, and remember, once a highway, this very thin road, a line of supply was cut, no ammunition or fuel was coming up that road. And what had they been doing for the last 2 days? They'd been fighting a battle in Nijmegen, and an armoured battle consumes a vast amount of combat supplies. And without that lifeblood of fuel and ammunition, an armoured division isn't going anywhere. The Irish Guards, for instance, had fired off the entirety of their ammunition supporting the Waal crossing, that heroic crossing by the American paratroopers. And really, the Grenadier Guards had fought for 2 days and hardly any of them were left. Yes, there was a company or a squadron of tanks left, but without infantry at night, a squadron of tanks is going nowhere.
There you are, Martin. Well, there's your situation. Is you've got a bridge. This is all in from a film, A Bridge Too Far. They've got over the Nijmegen Bridge. They're still looking at the Arnhem Bridge, which they're still just about managing to hold, but they simply run out of ammunition. At least that's the story. But this was at a much later stage in the war from D-Day. Things had been happening, hadn't they? One of the most important things in between times was on August the 10th, 1944, something called the Red House Meeting, which took place in Strasbourg, where a lot of the Nazi industrialists who, after the Falaise Gap battle, realised that basically that the Allied troops were heading for Berlin and they were going to lose the war, wanted to do a deal to try and make sure that their industries stayed in their hands after the war.
That's right. This is all covered in Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and in John Ainsworth Davis' book Operation JB, because he what he says in the book is that he was parachuted into Berlin to rescue Bormann. And of course this is all confirmed, if you like, I mean these are speculative books, but Reinhard Gehlen, who was the former head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, became the head of the West German intelligence services at the end of the war, and under Operation Paperclip, which people can look up, large numbers of Nazi intelligence operatives were in fact recruited into what became NATO's intelligence structure.
Now, we were talking.
This, of course, explains an awful lot about NATO's terrorist activities.
Well, we were talking last week, weren't we, about the Dulles brothers and the fact that one of them was the director of the CIA, the other was the Secretary of State, but they had been actually quite pro-Nazi even before the war.
Well, Prescott Bush, who was George W. Bush's grandfather, was arrested during the war by Franklin Delano Roosevelt for trading with the enemy. But of course these guys have got very good lawyers, and they managed to get off. But as NATO is being set up, and of course, you know, the Soviet Union was not a nice place, that you could see what the logic of all this was. Ultimately, as the war's coming to an end, we know that it's the Soviets who are going to be the enemy at the end of the war, and elements within the German establishment made contact with elements within the Western establishment and said, well, why don't we, between us, sort out what we are going to do when the war's over?
Now, what about this deal, at least potentially, between the Nazis and the Americans over uranium and plutonium?
Well, I mean, there are various aspects to these deals, weren't there? I mean, Wernher von Braun, who was the inventor of the V2 rocket, was, you know, swiftly absorbed into the US infrastructure, and of course, famously played by Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove. But also the intelligence officers, Klaus Barbie, for example, who was wanted by the French as the butcher of Lyon. He was sent to South America and was used by the CIA to train the Bolivian armed forces.
Okay, Martin, and we'll be hearing more from Tim Saunders in future weeks, and also exploring these connections between the Nazis and the Allies, the negotiations that were going on the road to Berlin. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, the new Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fordor. Thanks also to Old Ebrox for the economist, Martin Summers. You'll find this show online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Have a good weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile.